Hello and welcome. I'm Eric.
And I'm John.
And this is the Wikipedia Chronicles. This is a podcast where we start with a random article, explore it, then follow the links and see where it takes us. Today's starting topic is polymer substrate. So, John, why don't you start us off?
Well, polymer substrate is actually the process by which a lot of countries seem to make money out of plastic. A lot of countries, as you well know, use paper and metal in the production of their currency. But
even like cloth of some kind.
Textile material. But to improve durability and to prevent counterfeit monies being made in some countries, several countries, among them Australia, Romania, Vietnam, and New Zealand, have adopted the practice of making their money out of polymer or a type of plastic. And other countries also incorporate some plastic into their money. We have places like Mexico, Singapore, Nigeria, Chile. They all use money partially made out of plastic. So that's kind of interesting. Hmm. You don't really think about that.
Yeah. It's something like other countries, the way they do things, it's often you get a little narrow-minded with your own country, and it's like, well, this is all we see,
yeah.
So really there's no frame of reference for other parts of the world.
But at the same time, I think this may come off kind of strange, because the first thing that I thought whenever I read this article was like, these countries have like stupid poker chips for money, like they're using poker chips and like Monopoly money for coins and for currency. But no, what they mean is they're actually making engraved images on paper thin slabs of plastic, and that is what is their currency, and that's a little harder to do.
Yeah,
that makes it a little bit more legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of incentivizes me to go to those countries, or maybe talk to people who have been there to see if I can't get my hands on some of that plastic money, though.
Yeah,
see if anybody
sure.
who's been to Australia or New Zealand.
Be a nice little souvenir.
It would be. It says that they're also used as commemorative notes in other countries. So. Mm. Maybe if we stick it out long enough, we'll get one closer to home, like Canada. Canada likes to play around with their money a lot. They change the image on that stuff all the time. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I'm sure, I know the U.S., we just redid our $100 bills.
Oh, yeah, I've seen a
couple
of
like,
those.
They're all, like, blue, and they have that weird golden stripe down the side.
It's really strange looking now. It's not even a color anymore.
Yeah,
it's not green. It's everything.
It's all over the place.
Yeah.
Looks a little bit more like money from like Canada or something.
Yeah, Canada's done that for a while, where it's kind of been like a sort of tie-dye effect on their money almost. It's just kind of this color here, this color there.
Yeah.
But I mean, whatever you have to do to make it substantially harder to counterfeit is what you got to do.
Although I do have a fondness for the, money of like 20 years ago, like you see the older bills that are still have the old design, and it's very classic and just has the president in the middle or whoever it happens to be.
Right.
Because Benjamin Franklin's also one of
the
bills.
Right. And he's
for some reason.
Yeah. Well, he was sort of a president, but we can go into that later.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I do have a fondness for the older style bills. The new ones kind of look a little more fake.
Fake. Yeah. Unintentionally through making more real money that has made it harder for people to make fake money, it looks like fake money.
Yeah.
It's kind of a weird catch-22 there, but hey.
Looks like just a caricature of the original design. Okay, so where do we want to go? We have more or less only options of countries here.
Unless we want to look at a specific kind of currency, there's one link to Bulgarian currency called the lev here.
Oh, and there's also CSIRO.
The process of polymer substrate creation was developed by them in Australia.
So that's a company.
That might be interesting. unless we see any other countries on here that might be more interesting, do we want to find out about anything like Australia or New Zealand? Can bounce over to South America, Central America from here?
I don't know. I think I'm actually kind of interested in that Bulgarian banknote, the lev.
Alrighty, we can check that out. Let's go.
Let's do it.
Oh man, we plunged right into the thing with the language barrier, didn't we? Look at all that. I don't know, is that Greek? Is that Russian?
I don't know, where is Bulgaria? Is that near, is that, that it's gotta be Russian. I can't.
Bulgaria, I thought was kind of, because I always thought it was kind of like a German thing, because you always hear Germany be referred to as Bulgaria or Bulgarian, but no, that's, it's sort of close to Russia, but it's also sort of far?
Yeah.
It looks like it is, I don't know, two countries south of Ukraine or so? Not really, not really in Russia, but
that's,
I guess close enough
the
that
ballpark.
The influence is there, yeah. Yeah, you still have the same language structure.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's see about the Bulgarian lev here.
Okay, so I guess the lev is the currency itself, like their overall currency, like the U.S. dollar.
They have the dollar.
Yeah, so they referenced specifically the 200 lev.
Right, and that was for the commemorative note from the previous article for monies that were made out of plastics. Though it looks like in most cases in Bulgaria, these are still made out of metal. Of some sort. The one that's pictured is a gold coin. The lev means lion in the modern language. That word has since changed, but when they established the currency, it looks like the word still meant lion. So that's kind of what they have on the lev. It's a small little...
Makes sense.
Kind of very familiar, very routine European lion. Like, this is the kind of line you would see on the English flag of old, for example. It's just, if you want to talk about a lion in Europe, this is the sort of caricature you're going to encounter on any flag that's been around for more than 100 or 200 years.
Yeah. And it looks like it was introduced in 1881, so that's fairly new.
Yeah, yeah. I guess they were trying to kind of enter the world marketplace at that point, because it says that they entered the lev as a currency that would be equitable to the French franc, which at the time, late 1880s, French franc is probably pretty strong as far as currencies go worldwide.
So.
There's still a pretty large economy, France, so barring any major tragedies that I'm not thinking of, that's probably a pretty good place to enter the market at, really.
Yeah, for sure. And it looks like for a while they were backed by gold up until 1928.
They abandoned the gold standard even before we did then, huh? Oh, so they had sort of a collapse of their currency around the 1950s following World War II. It looks like they had to kind of reconsolidate everything where one new lev would equal 100 of the old lev. So they just kind of had to rein everything in economically, make their prices a little bit more legitimate. Because by the time World War II was over, they had lost so much money that they couldn't make a go of it anymore.
Yeah, well, that happens.
Oh, and then things got good. So another redenomination took place where the new lev in 1962 became equal to 10, or 10 of the new lev in 1962 that they established became equal to 1 of the new... The old new, how do you say that? One of the middle lev.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so their fourth go at the currency is their present iteration.
Whoa, and it's a big one. The lev was redenominated at 1,000 to 1, with the new lev equaling the Dutch mark. So that's very recent that happened, 1999. And since then, of course, the euro has kicked in, so a lot of people seem to be expecting the end of the lev altogether, since it's had a lot of inconsistency throughout its tenure as a currency.
Yeah, it seemed like some people were a little afraid to abandon their currency during the beginning of the euro.
Well, yeah.
Especially France.
Stands to reason. I mean, I wouldn't want to necessarily consolidate all of our currency with everybody else in North America, for example.
It's, yeah.
Ultimately, the economies would be stronger, but since the economies maintain their independence from each other, it becomes a very risky gambit, because you never know who's going to suddenly be like, well, we've been inflating things this entire time, and nothing's actually as good as we've been saying it is, and by the way, we're collapsing.
Yeah.
So you don't really want to have anything that's contingent on somebody else's success necessarily weighing in on the value of your dollar in your country, because that can really mess with you. Germany kind of experienced that during the financial crisis of 2008-2009. I remember seeing it on the news, they were constantly shelling out bailouts towards literally every other country you can think of. Bulgaria, I think, was one of them. I know that Turkey needed one, Greece. So their fears were pretty justified, I would say, in the end.
Yeah, I would think so.
All right, well, have we sated our quest for greed? Have we talked enough about money?
Yeah, I mean, I think so.
All right.
I don't think we need to go too far down the money trail here.
Yes, we need to find the root of all knowledge, not the root of all evil. Oh, but there are so many monetary options to go to from here.
Yeah, that's true.
Though there's also several country options. We could go... You go to the article of Cult of Personality.
I was just looking at that. I think we have to.
Yeah. Yeah, let's go. All right. Oh, wow. The pictures that come up immediately are just of Stalin and of Kim Jong-un statues in North Korea. Oh, no. What have we gotten in? Oh, no. Hey. And there's examples. There's an entire list of examples. Oh, this is exciting.
Maybe we'll get to hurdy-gurdy again.
We can always try. We can always accidentally try to head towards hurdy-gurdies. This is hopeful, though. I mean, we're already starting out with Stalin, so...
Yeah.
All right, so... Basics. What is a cult of personality? Well, it arises when an individual uses mass media to create an idealized and heroic image, usually trying to elicit some sort of worship from the people they are attempting to rule or impose a ruling image over. So, you know, you have your dictators of the world, your Castros, your Kim Jong-uns, Kim Jong-ils, so forth.
Yeah.
And those are kind of the well-known ones right off of the bat. But I wonder if this goes beyond just countries. I wonder if this is like, I mean, it says cult of personality. It doesn't say it has to necessarily pertain to the government, so...
Well, yeah, it doesn't say anything about government, so it just says mass media and propaganda, so, I mean, it could maybe, I don't know if this is the right realm, but something like Charles Manson.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Well, where, I mean, he didn't...
But he didn't use mass media, but that same idea of, like, just a person creating an image for themselves.
Right. Well,
maybe Kanye West would be a better example.
Yeah. He's used mass media to develop a cult. He's of
basically trying to get people to worship him.
Right. And I think that it's kind of working. I mean, people are fighting each other over his shoes, and they're just shoes. So he's having some success to that end. So that's a good example of somebody that's non-governmental.
Yeah, it does seem to be that a lot of them are indeed rulers of countries.
Yeah, probably because of where it came from. At first, the term cult of personality had no political connotations, but it was instead closely related to the romantic cult of genius. However, the political usage first came around in 1877 with, oh, look at that, our good buddy Karl Marx, founder of communism.
There you go.
Of course, just because the term wasn't used until that point doesn't mean that there were not people who fell under the example of it beyond that point. Looks like there were several imperial cults, namely places like China, Egypt, where there were very highly respected, almost emperor-type, deity-type people. We're talking your pharaohs and that kind of thing.
Yeah. there wasn't a whole lot of media back then, but what the equivalent would be, I'm sure they used that to boost themselves.
Yeah, they used ideas more than they used mass media. I mean, right. Basically they circulated the idea, like, you know, divine right of kings and how only certain people of certain bloodlines could ever ascend to the throne and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Nobody who was willing to admit that they were human was ever going to be a someone who was going to fall victim to a cult of personality in the ancient world. It was only somebody who was
right.
attempting to achieve some sort of supernatural aura. But it seems like that was literally all that was developing cults of personality until the modern age. It says it right here that photography, sound recording, film, and mass production, as well as public education, pretty well decimated the whole creating an aura of yourself being a god thing. Like, it just didn't work after a certain point.
Yeah, once people can, like, see you and hear you a lot, then they kind of are really able to form their own opinions about things.
And when they're able to see you and hear you a lot routinely, and they come to get used to that, and then one day you start aging, and then another day you die, eventually it becomes pretty hard to maintain the illusion that you're not gonna, you know, that you're not a human.
And also it does mention here that not all dictatorships foster a cult of personality.
Oh, okay. So we're talking, like, when we're thinking about people who foster these things, it's usually dictators, but it's not all the dictators don't go this route.
Right. Some dictators choose to keep low profile and just kind of rule behind the scenes.
Like who, though? I don't... I guess I wouldn't know of any because they've chosen to rule behind the scenes, but do you have any examples?
Well, it does say here Pol Pot is rarely seen in public. So, you know, there were several Eastern European communist regimes after World War II. So they kind of... I'm sure after World War II, people in Europe were kind of like, well, maybe let's not be super public. Yeah. And
I mean, after going through that whole Hitler thing, do you really want to have what that guy had?
Yeah.
Not so much.
I would probably try to keep a low profile, too, and just be like, hey, I'm doing good stuff.
I'm just ruling my country, you know, no manifest destiny here. But wow, there's a lot of countries in here that I had no idea had leaders that would have fallen into the term cult of personality.
Yeah.
I mean, you have your obvious ones that come to mind, but then there's even countries like Azerbaijan, which barely ever come up in conversation, have had these kinds of problems.
Yeah, and like as recently as 1993 and all the way up until 2003.
Wow. So that was an ongoing one for a while there where it may still be ongoing. It says that the dictator who had that cult of personality built around him, a guy by the name of Heydar Aliyev, he died and his son succeeded him. So, I mean, could very well be that it's still going.
Yeah.
Just with his kid, similar to how North Korea did.
Yeah, very much that could tend to happen.
Argentina, of course, had the popularity of Juan Domingo Perón, which is recounted in the events of the stage play Evita, as his wife is Eva Duarte de Perón.
And obviously there's they have the examples here of, like, Hitler and modern examples like Saddam Hussein and, you know, some of the more well-known ones, at least from an American standpoint. Because around... in America, we don't really tend to get a whole ton of world news. We kind of have to go searching on our own for that.
Yeah, it's not really dropped in our lap.
Unless it's major stuff.
I really enjoy the images of some of these people. Yeah. If you scroll down and you see this image of Gaddafi, who has been in the news recently as Libya has revolted against him, there's this really nice-looking, I guess, hotel lobby where it's just Gaddafi, like, throwing his hands up in the air. He has his hair in some sort of, like, weird 1980s hairdo, and he's wearing this really white suit, and I don't know, it just looks like he's, like, at, like, a soccer match, like, cheering because his team just scored a goal or something. It doesn't look like he's some sort of dictator figure at all. It's very strange.
It looks like a role Fred Armisen would play.
Yeah, he really doesn't look like a dictator, this guy. But that's Gaddafi, I guess. Every time I've seen him on the news, he was kind of like this shrouded guy, sort of bearded figure, sunglasses on all the time, nothing but a drab olive green button-down shirt on, that kind of dude.
Yeah.
Very different image of him back then. But hey, it was the 80s.
Well, where do you think we should go here? They say, see also celebrity, which celebrities are a kind of cult of personality, but I don't know. I wouldn't say they necessarily do it to themselves.
No,
usually
it's kind of worked
the media
up.
Itself is...
Yep, they generate that hype. There's also narcissism, narcissistic leadership, but I mean, that seems like that would kind of happen to a lot of leaders.
Yeah, I would think so. Especially like a dictator.
Yeah, but even if anybody wants to run for a democratically elected position, they have to be crazy enough to want to run an entire country. That's already pretty like a little narcissistic. Like, there's 300 million people who live in the United States. It's one of the best economies in the world. Yeah, sure, I can run that on my own. Me, I could be a branch of that government myself. What? What are you thinking? That sounds insane to say it like that. But I mean, that's essentially what. What you're volunteering for.
There's also Toxic Leader.
Toxic Leader is a good one. There's also a treasure trove of links within all of the various descriptions of examples here. Things like overthrow of the regime in 1989 in the case of Romania, or secret speech denouncing Joseph Stalin in 1956.
Secret speech.
Secret speech. There's also a link to political jokes.
A lot here.
Ooh. And then, of course, there's some really good ones in Spain. We have bullfighting, flamenco, generalissimo. We can follow generalissimo. It might take us to some interesting places. But probably not as interesting as bullfighting.
Bullfighting is really kind of tugging at me here because...
Well, everything else is just sort of mired in a sea of politics, which I'm just kind of like, you know what? If we have the opportunity to completely shed what we've just been talking about, we should take it. We should go.
Yeah, I think so, because I'm not too familiar with bullfighting other than...
I have cartoony images in my head.
Right, yeah, just that kind of stuff.
All right, let's go.
Oh, it actually seems to not be limited to Spain... Which I guess should be, obvious, but it looks like it might have started in Spain, and then now it's also in Portugal and France and, like, South American countries with Hispanic roots.
One thing that jumps out at me as being exceptionally interesting is that it's not even legal in all parts of Spain. Some parts of Spain have outright banned bullfighting.
I mean, I can kind of see why.
It is a blood sport. It says so right in the article. It is definitely not something that entirely avoids getting very gory at times.
Well, I see here the bullfight, as it is practiced today, involves professional toreros who they actually kill the bull. So the matador... Which I've heard that term before.
That's
the most popular term for a bullfighter. He's the senior torero, and he actually kills the bull.
Huh.
So I didn't know that they actually, like...
Put it down.
Yeah, I thought it was just, like, fight the bull, and then everybody goes their own way again. But I guess when you rile up a bull, might not be the best idea to keep it in solitary confinement for much longer.
Right. Well, it says that the overall process of bullfighting here places bullfighters, of course, at some risk, but the bull is weakened before the start of the fight. The bull gets hooked multiple times behind the shoulder by other matadors in the arena, and due to those injuries being sustained over the duration of the bullfight, that's why the matador goes out and puts it down at the end of it.
Oh, okay.
Traditionally, by a sword being driven through the bull's head with a single sword thrust, so they try to keep it kind of as humane as a prolonged animal torture sporting events can be, but...
So they try to end it humanely, whereas they started it as inhumanely as possible.
Well, yeah, yeah, it looks like it. Though there are still some who consider it to be a fine art and not a sport, as there are no elements of competition in the proceedings.
Well, that's...
Because nobody's... No, the bull is the enemy.
Yeah.
And since it's not human, it's not in competition. It's just there.
Right.
And the objective is to fight it.
But at the same time, I don't necessarily think I would call it an art form.
Yeah, it doesn't... It just seems sort of like a fun thing to watch. I don't know if you can really consider anything that's fun to watch not an art form. That's the problem, I guess.
That's true.
Because at that point, it becomes sort of a media of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm looking at the history here, and it says that bullfighting has roots in bull worship and sacrifice, which is interesting considering they torture the bull a little bit and then kill it.
Right.
Which wouldn't necessarily be something you do in a worship practice.
No, you would sacrifice it and that would be it.
Yeah.
And there may but be maybe, some ritual that would go on around it. But.
Maybe trying to wrangle the bull for the sacrifice is kind of where that bullfighting idea comes in.
Well, yeah,
where,
I mean,
like,
a bull
person,
would not be...
Like, running around, you know, trying to not get killed by the bull and then eventually
yeah.
kill it. Like, maybe they are just trying to recreate the scene of the old sacrifice, whatever.
Yeah, seems like that would be legitimate. It's affiliated with Mithras.
Hmm.
That's who the bull's usually being sacrificed for.
I am not familiar with Mithras.
Well, I will say this. I was also not familiar with Mithras.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just quickly, as I sometimes do during the podcast, I sometimes peek in on articles that we're curious about but we mm-hmm. don't agree to go to. And this one is actually pretty interesting. The term Mithras comes from the Mithraic Mysteries, which apparently was something called a mystery religion that was practiced in the Roman Empire from 1st to 4th centuries AD. The name of the Persian god Mithra, adapted into Greek as Mithras, was linked to a new and distinctive imagery during this time. And so they created a whole new mystery religion, which was called as such because mysteries were popular in the Roman military, and they sort of repurposed the image of this god to be some sort of mysterious figure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I went ahead and jumped over to this article as well.
Yeah, this is actually a little too interesting. I gotta find out more about this. So this is sort of like a secret society, I guess, that the Roman Empire was using for their soldiers. Because there's 7 grades of initiation, ritual meals, united by the handshake is a term that they use to describe how they met and periodically had their own handshake that they used to greet one another. We're back at cults again, as this one has several temples that still exist, many of which still exist.
Interesting.
That were underground in Rome, where the members met. So they were not very forward about there being a temple. They were trying to keep this sort of secretive.
Well, if it's a mystery cult, you'd think that, you know.
Well, yeah, you wouldn't secretive. Have it underground.
Right here. Iconic scenes of Mithras show him being born from a rock, slaughtering a bull, and sharing a banquet with the god Sol.
The sun god, that is.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
There's a lot of sites still around here, too. They say on the article that there are 420 sites that have yielded materials related to the cult.
There's 1,000 inscriptions in these sites, 700 of which are examples of the bull killing scene.
Oh, so that kind of goes right back to bullfighting, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So these guys really like killing their bulls.
Yeah, it would seem so.
There's even a huge statue of it right here.
But then this is also like the Roman Empire. This isn't specifically Spain. I mean, I'm sure their empire reached Spain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
but,
it did. At one point.
Maybe that's just where these sites were, and then it kind of lingered when the empire fell.
That would make the most sense. I'm, at this rate, compelled to say that one out of every five or so statues in this article has a bull in it in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
So they were very into their bull slaughter, that's for sure.
I would say so.
Basically, this religion seemed to be relatively short-lived. Although it was one that died out in the early 4th century with the revival of Christianity and pagan tendencies. So, no more room for Persian gods in the Roman Empire.
Now, when did the Roman Empire collapse?
Well, I'm sure that there's a link to the Roman Empire in this article about this Roman Empire mystery religion.
I believe so.
Let's follow it. Let's find out. This is going to be a huge article. Wow. Okay, so there are two eras to the Roman Empire. From 27 BC to 476 AD, the Western Empire of Rome
existed. That would have been 5th century?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much what you're thinking of when you say, you know, walking around the United States, when you say the Roman Empire.
Right.
These are the guys who wore the togas.
Yeah.
The guys who had the little, you know, olive branches behind their ears and were, you know, emperors. People who, you know, walked around with Jesus and did stuff. But ultimately, the Roman Empire, for being as involved in the Bible as it is, only being founded in 27 BC, that's cutting it pretty close, don't you think?
Like, yeah.
You wouldn't have thought from a lot of the history that, you know, we're familiar with that the Roman Empire was new. But man, was it new.
So I guess it's safe to say that around the end of the first age of the Roman Empire is when the classic Roman Empire fell and became pretty much contained to Rome itself.
Right, and that's kind of what we see, too, with the last page. That's sort of the same time frame. It's like it's like 100 years or so after the military religion that we were looking at before collapsed. So you can kind of see that Rome's power is lessening and lessening until finally it just sort of collapses entirely and becomes an entirely different thing.
Right.
Now, what do they mean by Eastern Roman Empire? Like, what does that contain? Because it looks like here, if you follow the capitals around, Rome was the capital of the Roman Empire, which makes sense because it's the Rome and Empire.
Yeah.
But then at around 330 AD, they changed the capital over to Constantinople, which is now known as
Istanbul. Not Constantinople.
Why they call it Istanbul, not Constantinople?
I don't know.
But they did change it, and that's in the middle of Turkey, though. That's a far cry from being in, you know, Italy.
Yeah.
So that's a bit of a jump. I wonder why that was. Oh, well. So there's a reason why Constantinople became the capital of the Roman Empire. The assassination of Alexander Severus in 235 led to the crisis of the 3rd century, which 26 men were declared emperor by the Romans of Rome by the Senate over a 50-year period. So that means that every 2 years, you had a brand new emperor by some way, shape, or form. Some less.
Interesting note. In America here, our election process for senators is 2 years, right?
Well,
am I correct?
We elect some of them every 2 years, right?
There is an election every 2 years, though.
Right. Every 2 years there is for some representatives, some senators.
Mm-hmm.
House of Representatives people only have a term of office of 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then Senate people have a term of office of 8.
Mm-hmm.
So they get to run for re-election once in a while, but
right,
whenever their terms are up, yeah, it happens every 2 years. So you'll have to vote for them during either the presidential election or the midterm elections in our society today.
But yeah, anyway, continue.
The thing that's kind of troubling here, and why it kind of ended up being a mess in Rome, was they stabilized the government by way of establishing a tetrarchy. where there were four emperors of Rome at the same time.
Sounds like a good idea.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know how that would have been considered stabilization. That seems weird to me, but whatever, I guess.
I mean, when has having four people ruling the same thing at once ever caused a problem?
I mean, probably never. I mean, it didn't break up the Beatles or anything. I mean, like, shoot.
Four people with equal power? How could that clash?
I mean, it's easy. It's like you give four people $1, each person gets a quarter. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
How hard is that? Actually, that's probably the only situation in which it would be easy to do. Okay, you four guys, watch over this $1. All right, that's fine. We'll do that.
Yeah, but then you have people killing other people to get bigger pieces of pie.
Exactly. That's kind of why the whole tetrarchy idea was unsuccessful, ultimately. And that led to a civil war, because by that point, the Roman Empire had four different emperors, each of which had allegiances and armies and things at their command.
Well, everybody's going to have their favorite.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's kind of like American Idol at that point. Roman Idol. Choose your favorite of the last four contestants for emperor. And they chose Constantine the First, who wasn't really chosen, I should say. He was the guy who defeated all of his rivals and successfully became the one and only, the one true king. The one true king. At which point, Constantine naturally relocates the entire capital to Constantinople, which he, renamed for himself. Remember that whole narcissistic leadership thing we were looking at earlier? It seems like we could have ended up here from that as well. We're chasing our tails here today, it looks like.
Yeah.
Ending up in a lot of articles that sort of tie into one another. So that was also around the time, that was 330 AD that all went down. And Constantine adopted Christianity, which later became the official state religion of the empire. And that is why you started to see the cult of Mithras sort of die out.
Mm.
That right there, that started the whole
thing. I
guess
that's what it would do, yeah.
Yep. So once they kind of relocated the capital to halfway across the Roman Empire, the Western Empire went to crap. And various other cultures, the Visigoths, the Vandals, who were an actual people group, by the way, that is slang. If you use Vandals to call people bad people, that is culturally insensitive. Hmm. So, just so you know. The barbarians, of course, they all took advantage of the fact that the military strength of the Roman Empire had since been moved elsewhere, and basically the Western Empire fell into decay and disrepair very quickly once the capital had been relocated.
Well, yeah, I mean, once the capital is no longer in the middle of the, you know, country or controlled region, kind of makes things difficult.
Yeah, makes it a little rough.
At least in a time where you don't have super speed travel.
Yeah,
such as airplanes and cars.
Yeah, everything takes a super long time to get where it's going. It's interesting to me that the Roman Empire was around until 1453, though.
Yeah,
like in some way, shape, or form, it existed until then. At which point, the Ottomans, or the Turks, as they are now known, came up and they defeated the Eastern Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty well into the Renaissance that the Roman Empire was still, you know, kicking along. Man, did we really choose a winner, though? I mean, that was just the briefest summation of what happens with the Roman Empire that we could have possibly given.
That is the top 1/20th of the article, maybe?
Yeah, this thing just keeps going. Oh my god. What have we done? And not to mention that, but every paragraph here has main article and see also article links at the top of each paragraph, which means there is quite literally an encyclopedia within Wikipedia of just stuff about the Roman Empire, which doesn't surprise me considering how influential they were.
Well, here's some interesting little tidbits. The population estimated in 25 BC, which is about the start of the empire, is 56,800,000.
That's
And by those days' standards, that's pretty high.
That's decent.
Because that's
pretty decent.
That's like, you know, roughly a sixth of America's population.
Today. Modern America's population.
So it's not too shabby there.
Yeah, not at all.
Especially for the beginning of the empire.
Yeah, that's really not bad. It says that at its peak, 70 million people were involved in the Roman Empire. And at the time, that was 20% of the world's population. So
yeah, that's pretty good.
That's substantial. That's pretty good for one empire, one country.
And as far as the size of the empire, I'll go by the mileage since, you know, that's what we're more familiar with.
Right. We don't want to use Roman units.
In the origin, again, 25 BC, it was roughly 1 million square miles, which is... That's pretty big.
Yeah.
Pretty big. And then by 117 AD, it was almost double that. So it took, you know, 75 years, but they pretty much doubled the size.
But it only took 75 years.
Yeah.
That might have even been faster than the United States. I mean, that's incredible.
That's true. Yeah, it took the United States, like... At least 100 years to
lock that all down.
Spread across, yeah. And, but then by 390 AD, when all the Constantinople business was going down, it actually dwindled down to only 1,690,000 square miles.
So it lost a lot, basically. It's almost as though if you have... an empire where the capital's at the center of the empire, you shouldn't move it to out on the very fringe of the empire, because the entire empire's strength is focused on that city.
Yeah.
It's named after that city. Everybody knows it. They like it there. You're kind of moving the keystone out of the key position by changing where that capital was. Constantine was obviously a very good military strategist, but he wasn't a good, you know, thinker dude.
Yeah. Maybe that's why they needed four people.
That might be.
He was a good, that part of it, but then somebody else was probably better at
logistics and like societal planning, civic engineering, that kind of thing. I mean, there is a huge legacy here from Rome, though. A lot of our... societal, linguistic, legal practices all came from Rome. And they haven't changed. I mean, they've varied in degrees of humaneness, but they've all not changed terribly much. They're the reasons why we still see linguistic similarities between Spanish and French.
Yeah.
Of course, they have a lot of really impressive landmarks. Quite a few amphitheaters of theirs. Colosseums and so forth are still standing today, the Colosseum in Rome, but there's also several other really well-preserved ones. One in Croatia is the best preserved. They still use it today for various events outdoors.
I think it's kind of strange how the further back you go in history, the longer things seem to have lasted as far as like man-made structures and items.
Yeah, you have things like these, the Great Wall of China, which is by no stretch of the imagination new.
Yeah.
The pyramids of Egypt.
Yeah, pyramids built in BC. They may not look as perfect as they used to, but...
Well, no, but for being but in the middle of still... a desert where they have sand whooping around them all the time...
They still, like, resemble the original things that were created. So, you know, I feel like you look at the things that have been built in the last 10 years, you know, 1,000 years from now, probably not going to look so good.
No, they're probably not
even going to exist.
Well, I mean,
I guess we do kind of tear things down and rebuild them anyway.
We do, but if you're building something, like if you look at skyscrapers, for example, those are things that are built to last forever and a half. They really want those things to survive earthquakes and natural disasters and all kinds of stuff. So they build them to last. If they take one down, it's only because they want to make room for something else, or something really bad happens to it. Like, nothing short of explosions really takes those things out, though. And it's, I think that we could see a lot of the skyscrapers we have built today, at least some of the early ones, stick around for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of how we kind of made them very carefully and very... we made them so sturdily that they'd be very hard to get rid of, basically. Yeah. I think I'd be really curious to see in 1,000 years how many skyscrapers we would have that would still exist in, like, a recognizable form. Like, yeah, they're not going to... The elevators, you won't be able to hop in and take the elevator at the Empire State Building anymore. But I can guess that maybe the Empire State Building might still be around.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Something like that. But I'm kind of... Looking at how many Roman amphitheaters here have survived, sort of bummed out about how many stadiums in the United States we just sort of put dynamite to after so many years and then just build a new stadium for different sports franchises, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I would really like to see how long they would hold up if we didn't destroy them to make way for new ones.
Well, we could dive into ancient Roman architecture.
Ooh, that would be kinda cool.
Inclined.
There's a lot of stuff in here. I mean, we have to pick something sooner or later, and that's that's a pretty good one, if I ask me.
Yeah, I mean, that's... I'm always interested in architecture.
All right, let's go.
Okay. Yeah. Looks like they pretty much were the front runners of using concrete.
Yeah, they used it really well. For example, the Roman Pantheon had the largest dome in the world for more than a millennium, and it is the largest unreinforced solid concrete dome to this day.
Wow.
Which is... testament to their mastery of the craft of concrete, I would say. that's pretty legit.
Mm-hmm. Well, it looks like they gained their architectural knowledge from Etruscan neighbors. Looks like
Etruscan.
I'm not familiar with that civilization.
Who are they?
Oh, okay, so it is now Tuscany area. Looks like, you know, it was in Italy, but around the Tuscany region.
Ah, okay. So...
So it's like next to Rome.
They just sort of absorbed those people into their empire, and that's kind of where they got their own flourishes. I mean, obviously, it's also largely influenced by Greek architecture.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess that's where you see innovations come from.
Yeah.
In there.
A melding of several different styles.
Mm-hmm. Whoa. It says that the Etruscans had given them various kinds of things for architecture, like hydraulics. In addition to the construction of arches. But I didn't realize that they would have had hydraulics that early on.
Yeah. I was definitely not aware that hydraulics were a thing back at that time. It's amazing how many things seem modern, but you find out that civilizations in, you know, several hundred BC were like, yeah, we're doing that.
Yeah, that's fine. It's normal. I'm kind of curious about the history of hydraulics now, personally. Like, how did that happen?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we can jump right over to that.
Okay.
Wow. All the way back to ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia.
What?
Water clocks had been used since early 2nd millennium BC.
Well, what's a water clock?
That's a good question. If I had to guess...
Oh, it's a clock that runs on water. Yeah. How about that?
I mean, I guess they had to tell time somehow.
They did, but... Water clock is timepiece in which time is measured by the regulated flow of liquid into or out from a vessel where the amount is then measured.
People get very resourceful when they just have a limited amount of things at their disposal.
And that's it right there. It's just two pots. So this is kind of like the ancient version of like a sand dial.
Mm.
Like when you overturn an hourglass and watch the sand trickle through, they basically did the same thing with water. Well, let's go back to hydraulics. Let's see, what do you mean by hydraulics exactly? They mean pretty much any application of liquid motion to the effect of mechanical action.
Right.
So the first real examples of that look like they are in China, namely the Turpan water system, or the Turfan water system, depending on your inflection, I suppose. Basically, that was a bunch of holes that were dug deep into the ground that allowed for any water runoff to be collected and then pooled at the bottom. So basically, it was just a combination of using the natural downforce of gravity with whatever rainfall fell to develop their town in their otherwise arid area of China. Which, again, I'm still kind of disappointed at. This is not what I'm talking about. When I'm talking about hydraulics, I want pistons, people. What are you doing? I guess these things count, but, I mean, come on. This isn't... This is so... this is
here's
boring.
Here's something.
It's droll.
In Greece, first hydraulic automata...
that sounds promising.
There was the force pump that they created, which sounds like, you know,
that's more like a pump. Yeah. So that's kind of pistony, so a little heavier.
And that was known for being used to raise water, and it was used in fire engines as well.
Ah,
and that is your piston pump.
Yes.
Right there.
Thank you, Greece. Thank you, base Greece.
There you go. Greece went ahead and made the first modern idea of the hydraulic.
It says that Hero of Alexandria describes a number of working machines using hydraulic power. Such as the force pump. So that was 10 through 80 AD. So by that point, they had already probably been in use several places.
Yeah, probably.
That's pretty crazy that something like hydraulics to that extent dates back even that far. 200 BC, 10 AD, that's not new technology.
Yep, not by a long shot. Well, in ancient Rome, they had already used hydraulics for public water supplies and making water mills and hydraulic mining.
Hydraulic mining that early?
Yep. They were one of the first to make a siphon to carry water across valleys and such. And they developed some of the first plumbing systems.
Well, that's important. That's just downright, you know, smart.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the first things you want to get working.
Yeah, when you've moved
after,
into the house.
After you got food and water, then you're plumbing. Like, oh, wait, we need plumbing.
Yeah, because
urgently.
The food and water goes into you, then where does it go? If plumbing is not the answer,
Yeah, it looks like it after, you know, early, like, or late BC, turn of the millennium or whatever, it doesn't really get refined until, or refined further until like 1600 AD.
Which is sort of following in the wake of the Renaissance and the Enlightenment and so forth. And that makes sense. So it isn't that the technology is not new. It's that we didn't bother innovating or developing anything else with it for, you know, 1,500 years.
Well, I mean, when you get something right the first time, what's the point in changing it?
True. I mean, I guess they didn't have too many applications, but I can think of numerous situations where, you know, it would have been a nice thing to have some of the innovations that we have today back then. Would have helped them.
Yeah, that's true. All right, well, I guess that's good. It's good there. I mean...
That's good.
That's good. That's a satisfying end to an episode. I mean, figured out what the deal with hydraulics is.
Yeah, found an interesting place. Found out that hydraulics have been around for forever and a half.
Yep. not changed for over 1,600 years. So anyway, there you go, from polymer substrate to hydraulics. If you enjoyed this, please visit facebook.com/TWC podcast and give us a like and follow, and then head over to iTunes and rate us and review us. And, you know, it all helps to spread the word and get us out there. And you can also find new episodes on our website, twc.ericturibio.com. And I'd like you to check out our neighbor podcasts, Enter the Critic, where they review movies in theaters and on Netflix, and then Ninjas vs. Podcast, where they take user-submitted matchups and figure out a winner. And I'd also like to thank Louis Armstrong for our theme song, and the California Ramblers for our outro song. Lastly, our totally true fact for this episode is that movie theaters were the first public institution to establish plumbing systems. So, there you have it. Thanks for joining us. I was Eric.
I was John.
And this was the Wikipedia Chronicles.
Oh, my word. That was a stretch. That was a reach.
I went for the animal hair. The birds and the beasts were there. The old baboon by the light of the moon was combing his auburn hair. And the monkey, he got drunk and sat on the elephant's trunk. The elephant sneezed and fell on his knees, and that was the end of the monk.